Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's carnival time in Louisiana, that time of year when the gods of mirth rule and the whole state turns a little topsy-turvy. For instance, Mardi Gras is when you may find yourself wearing your red beans instead of eating them. Crew of Red Bean founder Devin DeWolf joins us with the story of how he began a Lundi Gras tradition that has simply exploded. Devin teaches us all about what he calls beaning. And then Louisiana Eats producers Sarah Holtz and Joe Schreiner introduce us to some of Carnival's unofficial ambassadors, hospitality workers whose job it is to make sure our Mardi Gras visitors have a good time during their Carnival experience. Finally, we leave the city's Mardi Gras behind and head out to Cajun country for the Courier de Mardi Gras, a raucous tradition that involves horses, live chickens, and lots of cold beer. So get out your costumes and prepare to party on this week's Louisiana Eats. A pot of beans makes for perfect parade food because they simmer while the parade passes and are ready to feed an unexpected crowd when it's over. But at Mardi Gras time, there's lots more to do with your beans than just eat them. When Devin DeWolf founded the Crew of Red Beans over a decade ago, he had no idea that he was creating a new Lundi Gras tradition that has since developed a cult following. For those who don't know, Lundi Gras is celebrated on the Monday before Fat Tuesday. And in New Orleans, it's the day that red beans really shine. Devin took some time out from what's known as beaning to tell us all about it. Devin, this activity that you have created is something that you refer to as beaning. Tell me how that term came to be so broadly accepted.
We just started saying it. It kind of made sense at the time for these, you know, you get together with 25 people in a room and you all have your hot glue guns and your beans and we make these suits. And it just, I guess that version of the word was created. Maybe it's the only, I don't know, maybe it's a new word. Did we make a new word?
I don't know, but it certainly has a new meaning when it comes to the Red Bean Parade. I'd like to know the genesis. What is the seed of this thought you had?
Sure. So this is our 10th year, which we're very excited about. The first bean suit that I made was 11 years ago for Halloween when I had first moved to New Orleans because I was eating a lot of red beans and rice at the time. And I had just lived in Brazil and I was obsessed with beans because Brazilians eat beans a lot. So that had seeped into my soul. And when I got here and realized that New Orleanians eat red beans every Monday or most of or many of them, that connected with me. And so it inspired me for a Halloween suit. And then I made a bean suit thinking it would be a very quick, easy project that would just take me 20 minutes, took about 2 weeks. My roommate at the time thought I was insane. But when I wore it out and walked around Frenchman Street in the French Quarter, people kind of freaked out. It was almost as if I was a rock star, celebrity, or somebody.
What did that first bean suit look like?
The very first one, I think, had a map of the city on my back, maybe a fleur-de-lis out of beans, but I made pants and shoes and a jacket. And my first Mardi Gras, I had noticed, you know, Monday afternoon, it's a little quiet.
Yeah.
And Monday is the day for beans, so 20-something me thought, I'll just make a parade next year. And then that was the birth of the Red Beans Parade.
How in the world did you make it happen?
Well, I like to cook for large groups of people. And food is a great way to entice people. So what I did is I made a PowerPoint presentation of my plan, and I invited about 8 or 10 friends over for dinner, basically every friend I had at the time because I had just recently been here. And I fed them a wonderful meal, and then I showed them this PowerPoint presentation. And then I said, who wants to sign up for my crew, the crew of Red Beans? Who's in? And then that very first year, all of those people joined, and then word of mouth started spreading. And by the end of our first Lundi Gras, we had 25 people that had signed up for this group, which was great because that paid for a brass band. Got to pay the band. We had the Tremé brass band, and we had a nice little party where we elected our king and our queen and started planting the seeds of tradition. And then over time, it's grown. The first couple years, every week, we would get together at my house. I would make food for everyone, kind of like Thanksgiving, every single week. And people knew that if they came to Devin's house on Sunday evening, you could eat while you worked on your bean suits. And that's how I started it and got it growing and got it off the ground.
When it started, was it just all about red beans, or were there some other beans that were sneaking in?
We've never had rules. So it's really up to each member to create what they want to create. I don't try to be very specific or top down. There's different routes that people take with their costumes. Sometimes people go bean pun, like Benjamin Franklin, or sometimes they just make a pretty suit. Like, I always make a pretty suit. I don't usually have an idea behind my bean jacket or my bean outfit. And then sometimes people just are something like a chameleon or Ghostbusters or anything. It gets really creative, and that's kind of the magic of Mardi Gras for a lot of people, a lot of us, I would say.
Take us to the actual day of the parade. How does your day go on Lundi Gras?
Well, for me personally, I start with my traditional founder of a parade breakfast at the Cake Cafe in Marigny. And after that, I go to traditionally Elio's and purchase many kegs of beer for the day because the people must be hydrated. And then I put on my bean suit. I go to our pre-party, which is, for the last couple of years, has been at the Marigny Opera House. We cloister ourselves up and we decide our king and our queen. We mingle for an hour before the election, and so you get to see people and you get to look at their costumes and look at their craftsmanship and how they did and what kind of spray paint they used on their beans or how much glitter they've got. And all of that is taking place while the spectators are assembling outside. Once we have our king and our queen, then we open the doors and we come out to the crowd, which is a fun moment for us and a fun moment, I think, for the crowd. And then we parade for the next 3 hours. And for people who have never seen our parade, what I would say is that it's a little different than going on St. Charles or going somewhere else in the city, because you can really be in the parade. There's no like roping off, or there's no sidelines.
You just
march along with us, and we have lots of people who show up in their own bean suits now. We don't even know who they are. They just make their bean stuff at home, and they show up in these costumes, and that's pretty fun too. That's accidentally become part of the tradition.
I understand there's a bean mobile.
There is. We a couple years ago transformed a 1970s Volkswagen thing into a bean mobile. It's completely covered in beans. It's beautiful. And we actually have a 1969 Cadillac hearse that we purchased this year to make that into another bean car for the second parade that we're doing, the Dead Beans Parade.
How did you decide where to cap the number of participants?
It's actually sort of a problem-ish that was created because we wanted to have our pre-party at the Marigny Opera House. And it's a beautiful space, and they're really happy to work with us and support us. But you can only have so many people inside, and that kind of created a cap of membership. But I also realized that's kind of a good thing because there's a certain magic of a small parade. And if it gets too big, it'll sort of lose that magic and that identity. And luckily, the solution to all that is we just created a second parade.
So 2018 is the birth of the Dead Beans.
Yeah, this year we're going to have two parades.
And how did the Dead Beans come about? What's their origin?
They began 9 years ago, and every year in the Red Beans Parade, we had a group of people that dressed up as skeletons, and they started calling themselves the Dead Beans, and they sort of evolved this tradition inside of the Red Beans Parade. And when I realized I already have 100 members, more people want to join, we're going to have a second parade so that those people can join us, it seemed very natural to have a spinoff. And so we decided that the second parade is the Dead Beans Parade, which will have its own sort of flavor, a little bit different than the traditional Red Beans Parade, but still a bean parade. Different style music. We have Panorama, Brass Band, and Bon Bon Vivant instead of the traditional Tremé brass bands that the Red Beans Parade has. But it'll still be really fun, very danceable, very family-friendly. And the Dead Beans have decided that their suits are more either paying homage to someone who's passed away or a play on any type of cultural, folkloric dealing with death. And that runs the gauntlet from laughing in the face of death or paying homage to ancestors or anything, because we have a lot of members from different traditions, right? We have people who are African Americans or New Orleanians by birth. We have people who are Hispanics. We have people from different parts of America. We have a member coming from Australia. You know, she might bring some Australian thoughts on death in her suit. I don't know. We'll see. But pretty much any, there's no rules, but that's sort of the costuming that we're going for. My suit this year is a skeleton suit with, I've taken black eyed peas and made the skeleton outline, but then I've filled in the skeletons with rice and I've placed each individual grain of rice one at a time. And they're all facing the same direction. It's very OCD of me, but it looks really cool.
How long did it take you to do that?
Oh, we start working in November. Oh. So 4 months or so of bean suit creation. We meet up every Monday night at a bar in the Seals Class Act Lounge, wonderful little bar in the 7th Ward.
Devin, how heavy are these suits?
Some of them get quite heavy. I've definitely made suits that are in the 60-pound range. And the beans add up real quick, and the hot glue adds up real quick. So weight is always something that we have to consider.
And how does that kind of weight behave as you're moving through the street?
Part of it when you're parading is, you know, by the end of it, you're exhausted and you're a little sweaty and you've done all this hard work all year to prepare. But that's part of it. That's part of the magic. And I think at the end of the day, if you feel exhausted, then you did it really well. And you have something to be proud of.
You don't save your bean suit from year to year. That's an important thing to remember.
Yeah, and that is a good connection to the New Orleans culture and the inspiration of Mardi Gras Indians, who, of course, make their suits every year. And for me personally, I think that's a wonderful part of our tradition, that every year you have to make a new suit and you have to go through that process of, you know, we spend 4 months making our suits and we spend so much time and so much energy and effort that goes into them. But then after Lundi Gras, that's it. They're gone. And you're already thinking of the next one. But I will say that 1 year I set my shoes outside and they sprouted.
Oh, that's hilarious. How long did it take?
A couple weeks. And then I looked back and I was like, oh, they're sprouting. Those are my shoes from Lundi Gras. And then now they're sprouting beans.
Devin, I am so excited about Lundi Gras. I'll be looking for you on the streets.
Well, thank you. It's a most fun day of the year for us, and we welcome everybody to come out with us. As we say, there ain't no bean like a red bean, or ain't no bean like a dead bean, and there's certainly no city like New Orleans.
That was Devin DeWolf, founder of the Crew of Red Beans.
Every year for carnival time, we make a new suit. Red, yellow, green.
Next, we hear from French Quarter-based service industry professionals. They tell us about their unofficial jobs as ambassadors to the city. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
So when we're out at carnival, we'll be
Thank you.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and also from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. We've launched a new podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites. The podcasts are mini episodes combining new material not yet aired on the show and lots of recipes too. Subscribe today on our podcast page at poppytooker.com. That way, you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our new Quick Bites podcast. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Every carnival season, it seems like the population of New Orleans triples in size. Tourists from all over the world descend on the city to partake in our festivities. As part of KCRW's 24-hour radio race, Louisiana Eats producers Sarah Holtz and Joe Schreiner hit the streets of the French Quarter. They spoke with members of the service industry about their interactions with these out-of-town visitors.
Well, people are in rare form. You've got to have that thing out today. People are live at 5.
Let's say you're visiting a new city for business or pleasure, and you have some time to kill. What's it like to have a real, authentic experience?
Joe and I live in New Orleans, a city known for its year-round partying. New Orleanians are generally a welcoming group of people, and the economy depends on tourism, so the city tries to give tourists what they want.
Its welcoming committee is also varied. It's made up of bartenders, artists, street performers, pedicab drivers. Struck by our curiosity about this idea of authenticity, we spoke with several of these unofficial ambassadors, or whatever you want to call them.
I would say that I'm writing a love letter to this city. I don't know if I'm an ambassador. When I run for mayor, then we can talk about it.
And they explained how they communicate with tourists, especially when nobody knows exactly what these visitors are looking for.
It's interesting. A lot of people don't really know what they want, but I get a lot of the whole authentic New Orleans experience question.
Oh, yeah. And I'm like, well, what does that mean to you? I'm like, what, like, Marie Laval's tomb's over there, and the brass bands are over there, and the streetcar will be here in about 5 minutes. Like, there you go. And you can yell, like, some Tennessee Williams quote at it if you want.
Every night, I get people that come and ask me, my favorite is, where can I get some real New Orleans jazz? And I don't even think they really like the jazz that they're asking for, but they feel like they're obligated to ask for it.
I mean, they're asking you because they're like, the only thing I know is Bourbon Street. Is there something else to do? It kind of depends on the person asking the question, because not all of our experiences are the ones that they want to enjoy while they're here.
Yeah, do you send them to the fried chicken place or the punk and metal show, you know? It's like kind of...
Yeah, right.
If they're the people that want Girls Gone Wild, then Bourbon Street is that way. And when I first moved down here, a friend of mine took me to Bourbon Street. I made it about 2 blocks, and I was like, you've got to get me. This is awful. You got to get me out of here. And he goes, oh, you hate it. He goes, you're going to love New Orleans. This is where we keep them.
There's all sorts of shit you can do, but that's that right there. That's a trick question, too. Like, what is a New Orleans experience? You can't quantify that. I mean, it's different for every single person in the city.
To be sure, these ambassadors are ambivalent about what they want to share with tourists, depending on how that first interaction goes.
Kind of depends on the people. If they really just want to enjoy it and they have a level of respect for the history and the people and a sensitivity to the fact that they do not live here, then I'll tell them the little secrets that I like to hang out in. But if I don't want to look at them again, then I'm going to send them far away from me.
I don't give my secret spots unless it's somebody I really like. Like, I have a date spot. So City Park is like 2 miles straight shot. And it's my favorite. So when customers are red, that's exactly where I send them.
So people have to earn the secret spots?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm not trying to give my secrets away so that I'm surrounded by turds all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like group of tourists come in, they ask you like, oh, where's good to eat? Where's good to drink? And like, well, like, I know my friend's working at this bar tonight. Would they be okay with me sending this group of tourists there? you know, it's like you don't want to give away too many secrets to people that aren't going to appreciate them, you know?
Honestly, I sent a lot of people to the gumbo shop. Like, I literally just sent two girls there right now, and I was like, seriously, like, I ate there like 2 weeks ago. I mean, they make my rent, so I have to be a little bit like, what can I do to help you out for sure?
But if tourists are truly open, if they're truly up for anything, a connection can be made, and no one stays a stranger for too long.
I really enjoy with the customers, and this is the truth, to give them my secret spots. And I'll give them my cell phone number, like, text me, let me know how it is, because I love to hear about myself. I love to hear how right I am. It makes me feel so good. And they do, and it's fun, and then I keep in touch with these people. When they come back and see me. It's awesome.
I mean, like, I have run into customers, like, hours later at places I've told them to go, and they've bought me a drink.
And it's fun to be a part of somebody's trip. You know, it is. And I like giving them that little bit of something.
This piece was produced by our very own Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
I was a stranger in the city, out of town were the people I knew. I had that feeling of self-pity, what to do, what to do, what to do. The outlook was decidedly blue. But as I walked through the foggy streets alone, it turned out to be the luckiest day I've known.
One of the many awe-inspiring parts of Carnival are the exquisite costumes that revelers labor over year-round to premiere on Fat Tuesday morning. My friends and veteran thespians Brian Batt and Tom Cianfici share my love of costume culture. So we had a little chat about what they look forward to every year at Mardi Gras. Tom and Brian, I am so curious to hear about Mardi Gras in your life. What do you all do when it's Mardi Gras time?
Run.
No, I'm kidding. No.
run to St. Charles to watch a parade.
A costume is a must.
Oh, God. Yes.
You cannot walk out the door on Mardi Gras day without a costume.
No, I'm a firm believer. None of this purple, green, and gold rugby shirts.
Yes.
That's
no.
Lame. You've got to get a hat.
Or a rainbow clown wig.
Yeah, no, that doesn't count.
No.
But it really is fun. It's, you know, this is the day that you can just
be as creative as you want to be.
Funny and
whatever you anything want. Anything goes.
Yeah, anything goes. Let your inhibitions run wild, or if there's something you always wanted to be or dress up as or play at, do it. That's what it's for. And no one, you know, there's no judgment. That's what I love about it. You know, that's fun. We used to live on the parade route, literally on the parade route.
You never know how many friends you have until you live on the parade route.
It's so true.
No, that's the
well,
truth.
How coveted a bathroom is.
well, it's. I think that... you know, people outside of Louisiana get the wrong idea about what Mardi Gras really is.
Mm-hmm. And Sadly, they do.
And uptown, it's such a family.
Yeah, it really is a family
thing.
Tradition.
And, you know, I don't think people realize that.
Yeah. That's why I tell everyone to go watch it. You know, go on St. Charles, around Napoleon, St. Charles, and further down too. You know, and a lot of people on the Bourbon Street, that's a different crowd. You know, I don't bring the kids there, but everyone has their place. You know, where they prefer to watch the parade, you know, and the celebration. And that's what I love about it. It's for everyone. And it's there's nothing like it anywhere else.
Well, I'm an uptown girl who always was a St. Charles Avenue parade watcher. Mm-hmm. But I must confess that on Mardi Gras Day, I'm inextricably drawn to the Marini.
Yes, I just got to go to the St. Anne.
He called and where was I? I was doing some talk somewhere, and Tom goes, you are not going to believe these costumes. You're not going to believe these costumes. They're brilliant. What do? They work all year round for these magnificent...
Yeah, I worked forever on mine, and I thought I was going to stand out. I was like, oh, God, you're boring.
And you were the Sun King.
I was Louis the 14th as the Sun King.
Yeah. I mean, it was this historically accurate, gorgeous, you know, gilded, fantastical
costume.
You know, and then you paled in comparison to the rest. But what was that when you walked by and someone was getting married on a stoop?
Oh, yeah. Somebody just decided to get married and there was somebody there who could do it and they just did.
And everyone, on all the people in costume were their wedding party.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
You know, how magical. You know, what we need in this life and in this world, especially now more than ever, and you can always say that, is a little more magic.
Exactly. And we have our magic to look forward to every year. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for talking all this holiday fun. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Right back at you.
Tom Gianfici and Brian Batt.
Down in New Orleans where the blues were born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On La Salle and Rambaugh Street, the combos play with a mambo beat. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo.
Carnival isn't just about parades and parties. There are elements of sociology, religion, theology, and folklore behind every float, mask, and meal. Few people understand this better than Errol Laborde, author of Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival. We sat down with Errol for a passionate discussion of carnival time and the history behind Louisiana's most renowned cultural celebration.
There's a chapter that I did, one of my favorite chapters, and it's about the 1870s. And the significance of that decade was that was the year of the first Rex Parade. Now, by that time, there was already two parades in New Orleans. There was Comus and 12th Night Revelers. But Rex sort of really put Mardi Gras on the map in that it was the first day parade. And with Rex, you created this character who was the king of carnival. And with Rex, Mardi Gras in New Orleans really began to grow into a major event. The same year, Mobile, which already had a parading tradition, created a king of its carnival called King Felix. And Memphis started a carnival. And there were several towns that in 1872, out of the blue, were creating carnivals. Part of it, I realized, had to do with Reconstruction and the Civil War. It was a bit like after Katrina here, that there were people saying, hey, look, come back to our town. We're rebuilding. We're doing things. Here's something special to see. But also, I discovered, though, that there were some towns in Europe. For example, a town called Via Reggio. Via Reggio had an ancient carnival tradition, but in 1873, it reorganized its carnival and made it more of a marketable sort of thing. And in Nice, which isn't far from Via Reggio, just right up the coast and over the French border, they'd been celebrating carnival since the 1200s. But also in that same time period, they developed like the Nice Carnival Association. So all of a sudden you see, not just in the United States, but in Europe and other places, by the 1870s, creating, formalizing, really structuring a carnival. And the common denominator, because obviously the Civil War is not a factor over in Europe or Reconstruction, mm-hmm. The common denominator is the railroad. Because by then the passenger railroad is becoming onto its own. I mean, there have been railroads, but there's developing passenger railroad markets. And if you got a passenger railroad, you got to create destinations. And with the first Rex Parade, passenger railroads, you know, printed these flyers and they had them in train stations up and down the line. Come to New Orleans and see the parade of the King of the Carnival. This was the era of the Industrial Revolution and steam power, and it was just part of that, that people were becoming more mobile and there was ways for people to get around. And carnivals were a good way to mobilize people and give them something to come in and to discover.
And discover it they did. Since then, carnival has become a mainstay in Louisiana that's been celebrated by costumed revelers despite world wars, police strikes, and even the aftermath of that big weather event in 2005. Through it all, carnivals developed into a major economic engine in the state, due in part to Super Cruz, Bacchus, and Endymion, and the old line traditions of Proteus and Rex. It might be an understatement to call some of their food celebrations decadent.
There was a float group for one crew that for many years had its own party at Antoine's. Mm-hmm. And one of its objectives was to have a party that was as expensive as possible. Right? And so this crew would get together in one room and they would order for the group, you know, right off the oysters and the souffle potatoes and everything. They'd just serve and they'd have wine and they'd just dance. And they'd have dancing girls of various sorts too. And then they would march. This was back when the parade was leaving from the auditorium. Mm-hmm. They'd have these guys with American Fire wagons and they'd pull the wagons and the wagons had ice chests full of champagne. And they would march to the auditorium and get ready for the parade. So by the time that they got on their floats, they were fueled with an afternoon dinner at Antoine's plus champagne along the way.
Well, that's actually a pretty common tradition that a lot of the old line groups have luncheons before their big ride.
You know, at the carnival balls, there used to be a great tradition back when they were at the Municipal Auditorium that they'd have these huge parties backstage at the ball. Turtle soup was very common, and the mythology behind turtle soups, I mean, maybe it's true, was that turtle soup had a sobering effect. And so that was always something that you'd serve, and there'd be party sandwiches, and it was a big, big deal.
That turtle soup, it's always sobering when it's got that shot of sherry
in it, huh? Yeah, that always helps.
That makes good sense.
But then what happened under a previous city administration, they gave the food concession to some guy who just jacked up the prices tremendously, and they made it mandatory that you had to get it from this guy. So the crew said, well, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And now you go backstage at the ball, and they may have, like, peanuts or something and some drinks. But more often what they'll do is that the crew will meet earlier that day, perhaps at a place like Galatoire's or Antoine's and Arno's. On Lundi Gras, there's the big produce lunch at Antoine's, and you walk by there, and it's such a juxtaposition. You see your Mardi Gras street people, and then you see your produce people, the produce ladies who are always dressed very nice, the produce guys who got the signature red tie.
Yes.
And they're just walking together. And, you know, it used to be that after the produce luncheon that quite often they go to another bar nearby. Mm-hmm. In the last few years, somebody at Antoine's got smart, and they put a bar count in front of Antoine's. And so they get them inside and outside now.
Errol, sometimes they throw food from the floats, don't they?
The law is, if you throw food, it has to be packaged. I mean, you can't just go and throw a hot dog or a piece of chicken or something like that. So throwing food is not really encouraged. But one thing that has become a tradition is moon pies. And that is not unique to New Orleans. That probably comes through Mobile because moon pies were developed out of Chattanooga. And so if there is one edible throw that you could kind of link with Mardi Gras, it's probably the moon pie. What I'm trying to advocate, and really getting nowhere with doing this, for watching the Rex Ball,
yes.
If you're at home, I think that the perfect supplement to have while watching it is moon pie and champagne.
Okay.
So I really urge people, while Rexing the Ball, have a couple of moon pies and have a glass of champagne and watch the Rex Ball with that, and can't ask for anything more.
I loved that you had an epilogue that you entitled Stir Me Something, Mister. Right. That's a great line. I really like that. And in that, first you list what you consider the 16 top foods of the Louisiana Mardi Gras. So I was hoping that we could chew that over together.
Okay, it was totally unscientific. It was me just kind of trying to figure this out. And keeping in mind, here I am talking about the Louisiana Mardi Gras, which is different from the New Orleans Mardi Gras. It's not the same kind of history or sociology or that sort of thing, but it's a parade. There are different destinations for the Cajun Mardi Gras. Different towns have their own celebration. There's subtle variations in between them, but they all borrow from what is called the begging tradition of carnivals. And this begging tradition is really ancient. It goes back to medieval Egypt, where peasants during a certain day of the year would go to the nearby castles, and they would essentially beg by putting on some sort of entertainment. The lords in the castle would give them a chicken or some food things. And the lords probably said, you know, this is probably better than the revolution, you know, so let's do this. So there is a long-established tradition of people going and begging for their supper, I mean, providing their entertainment. I guess perhaps our trick-or-treat kind of, you know, developed in that spirit. And so look at the Louisiana Mardi Gras, which to me is a little bit different from the New Orleans Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. I had, first of all, barbecue. That's a big thing during Mardi Gras, especially on the parade route. And increasingly in New Orleans Mardi Gras, on the St. Charles route, boudin, okay? Uh-huh. Now, boudin is not a really big New Orleans food. I mean, it's becoming more popular. But to me, it's a great parade food because it's contained. I mean, a good sausage, I mean, you can just hold it, and you can just chomp into it, put a little mustard on it. And so I think at the other destinations around the state, that boudin is a good parade food. Something else to put in, though, is cracklins.
Uh-huh.
Which would also be a good party. I mean, anywhere where you're doing pork of any kind, especially if you're doing it from a boucherie, I mean, you got cracklins. And cracklins, you can also just bring a bag to the parade and eat it like potato chips, too. It's not what you call a health food.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, but I say like 3 or 4 cracklins a year is okay.
That's Errol Laborde, author of Mardi Gras,
chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival. Look for Errol and his wife, Peggy Scott Laborde, on Mardi Gras evening when WYES televises the Rex Ball and Meeting of the Courts. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
While you go to New Orleans, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. If you go to New Orleans, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. When you see the Mardi Gras, somebody'll tell you what's carnival for.
With long days of Mardi Gras partying ahead, how can you be sure the food you're serving remains safe? Stay tuned, and when we come back, I'll share those important guidelines with you. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans bold. This week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How can you be sure your food is safe to eat during the long days of Mardi Gras partying? Keep hot food hot and cold food cold. Hot means 140 degrees. Cold should be a minimum of 40 degrees. You've got about 2 hours at room temperature before bacteria begins to develop at risky levels. So only put out as much food as you expect your guests to consume within that 2 hour window. Then replace it with fresh, because a tummy ache is never a good party favor. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Our friends at Bayou Teche Brewing in Arnoville are experts at taking ancient beer-making methods and adapting them in special Louisiana ways. Apart from their impressive regular lineup of craft ales, the brewery offers a special release every spring, Courier de Mardi Gras. The ale celebrates the old Cajun version of Fat Tuesday, celebrated throughout Acadiana. Bayou Teche founder Carlos Knott and his sidekick, Louis Michaud of the Lost Bayou Ramblers, joined us to talk about the beer and the Cajun Mardi Gras experience.
Our Mardi Gras in our part of Louisiana is much different than over here in New Orleans, and we wanted to celebrate that ancient tradition, that Courier de Mardi Gras, with a French-style beer. It's a Bière de Mars, which is a March beer in English. And
Mardi Gras is a little early, so I guess we're just jumping on the March beer a little
early. Well, you know, sometimes we get it in March. But in France, it's a style of beer that's brewed in farmhouses. And it's usually brewed at the end of the last season. So it's all the freshest crop of all the barley and the hops. And they put it away for the winter and break it out in March. And it's usually a pretty strong beer, I guess, as well. So this beer for us is all imported French barley and hops. And it's about a 7.5% alcohol. It's a smooth beer, so it'll sneak up on you as well. We expect to see some of the riders this year fall off their horses.
Tell us a little bit about what that Mardi Gras experience is like over there in Cajun country. How do y'all celebrate?
I guess I can tell you about how we did it growing up, and then Louis can probably tell you about the history of it more than I can. But my grandparents grew up in a little small town called Bayou Portage. Portage is like to carry your boat across the water, which is how narrow this bayou is. You can literally walk across it. They would do the courier in those days. It was all these men would dress up in these real gaudy handmade costumes, and they'd cut up in French and scream and holler and till you gave them something, and then they'd leave the house.
And like an onion or a...
The prize was a chicken. They'd throw a live chicken out, and people would chase it. They'd get on their horses. Of course, they were all tissoulet, a little drunk.
Uh-huh.
And some of them would fall off their horses. But they'd cut up to give them an ingredient for the gumbo. And at the end of the day, they made a big pot, and everybody would show up. And there was French music. It's really nice. It was kind of like utopia almost. Everybody got together, and there was potato salad and desserts. It was just a blast.
And how about you, Louis? How do you celebrate Mardi Gras?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do, too.
Still.
Yeah, that's there's definitely a bunch of couriers still happening. There's Church Point, Mamou, Lance Meg, Lance Lejeune, that goes on and on. But either way, it's definitely about getting together and not hiding behind the mask, but just being somebody else for the day and letting yourself go. And like, you know, all the small towns where a lot of these happen, the social restrictions just out the water, you know, because in small towns, you know how it is socially.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, it's your one day to just completely let loose, and anything goes on that day, really. And that's when it's your chance to go heckle your neighbors, and they don't know who you are. So you get it all out on that day, you know. And then if you're lucky, you don't get whipped too bad. The whipping can be part of the traditional, you know, a real pelt, you know. You get tanned a little bit.
And each town has its own variation of the Mardi Gras song is the other neat thing. It sounds the same, you know, if you don't know French, but each little town has its own variation. And
how does the song go?
Le Mardi Gras s'en vient de tout partout, tout le tour, le tour de Moye. Ça passe une fois par an, monde la charité. Quand même, c'est un patate tout de gratin. And then it goes on to say all, you know, that's...
Could you translate for us?
Yeah, the Mardi Gras riders come from everywhere. Le Moye is, there's a couple translations of that. It could be the hub or it could be the stump. You know, it's kind of like this thing, to de Mardi Gras, all around the stump is where the Mardi Gras is. You kind of, you know, go in this little dance in a circle. We come once a year to ask for charity, for donations from the house, even if it's a potato or some gratin.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes on to say, oh, you know, will you accept this band of drunkards? Will you accept this band of Mardi Gras? We only come once a year. That's all we ask.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
Some towns like Mamou, I think they live just for that 2 days because there's nothing else going on the rest of the year.
Brewmaster Carlos Knott and Lost Bayou Rambler Louis Michaud brewing up some Mardi Gras fun at Bayou Teche Brewing. Now that we have a taste of Courier de Mardi Gras, we turn to two Acadian natives to learn even more. Based in Lafayette, cultural correspondents Toby Rodriguez and Lucius Fontenot let us in on their Cajun carnival traditions.
So out here in the prairies and the area outside of New Orleans, we have the Courier de Mardi Gras, which is a horseback Mardi Gras where people participate as opposed to watching parades. And the whole idea behind it is community. Once again, it's very important around here. Something that people hear about is the chicken chasing part of it, which is always a fun thing. The farmer or neighbor will give you a live chicken and say, you're welcome to have this, but you must catch it first. And there's a dance at the end of the day with a gumbo, and everyone celebrates and has their last hurrah just before Lent.
We're fortunate that some of the older people in our immediate community that don't run anymore have taken on the obligation of cooking our gumbo. The thing is that, like, these revelers from this community go from door to door, go to the different voisins, the different neighbors, and receive donations for the gumbo. Mm-hmm. So the gumbo traditionally wouldn't have been started till after the Mardi Gras got back to that home position. But, you know, because there's like 500 hungry, drunk people that really need a bowl of gumbo.
That's a lot of gumbo.
That gumbo started early that morning by these older guys who have taken on that role. There's definitely a lot of community at that point. the major difference between New Orleans and the Cajun country Mardi Gras. That's a spectator sport, and here it's participation. There is no one like standing on side of the road watching us pass. Like, we are the parade. The understanding behind Mardi Gras is that you have a day to be anonymous. You get to be mischievous or canaille and get away with some things that, you know, sociably maybe you couldn't get away with. You know, you get to act out of yourself. And I know for me personally, I become a really, really mean person Mardi Gras day. And I would like to think that most people wouldn't think I was a mean guy most of the time. But on that day, I get to shed all that negative stuff.
And it's all behind a costume.
Costumes differ. Traditional costumes, the headpiece is a capuchon. There's a screen mask. You know, they're very multicolored. It's supposed to contrast. Mardi Gras is all about contrast. At that time of the year, you've got, you know, some nice silver gray skies. There's no leaves on the trees just yet. A lot of dead winter grass. So it's a very dull palette, and these costumes contrast that palette. They're very colorful. They're filled with fringes. The traditional costume designs are basically set to mock the authority figures. So you have the capuchon, which mocks royalty. There's also like the bishop's mitre.
Yes.
Is pretty popular. And then there's the what the professor wears. That's another common. But you could also you could mock just about anyone. You know, we've had people dressed up as presidents sometimes. The most important thing is that you have to know what that run is going to expect out of you. Some runs don't care about being completely disguised the entire time.
And the customs and the traditions of the run differ by neighborhood.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Give me some examples.
Let me see. What can I divulge?
Is it like a secret society too?
Well, it is some like things about those runs that are kept secret. You have to run it to experience it. Uh-huh. There are some runs that have an initiation, like a hazing that goes on before the run for new runners. There are some runs that don't allow women. There are some runs that are co-ed. There are some runs that are just strictly women. Some runs that have a traditional costume that is expected of you and that everyone wears that style costume, where other runs are a little bit more tolerable. They accept just about anything. If you run our run, I'd only have one bit of advice, and it's put on your mask.
Absolutely, and go ahead and dance with your id.
Alors la Mardi Gras!
That was Toby Rodriguez and Lucius Fontenot, men who live out their cultural roots.
De la charité, comme un petit simple mec et ton cap, ton maillot.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched a new podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites. The podcasts are mini episodes combining new material not yet aired on the show with lots of food history and recipes, too. Subscribe today on the podcast page at poppytooker.com so you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our new podcast. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from the Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood and American whiskey on Bourbon Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.